Do you want a drink?
Yeah, sure. White Russian.
There's a special rung in hell reserved for people who waste good scotch.
A martini, shaken, not stirred.
Try the wine.
You slip me a bottle of bourbon, a little glass, and some ice.
It comes in pints?
Oh, I'm getting one.
I drink, and I know things.
This is episode 8 of the Ruminations podcast. I am Steve. I'm here with Chris, and tonight we are going to be talking about exorcisms and our favorite genre of horror movies, exorcist movies. Chris, would you like to introduce what exorcisms are, since you're the lay exorcist expert?
I'm working towards my degree to become a full-fledged exorcist. I'm not. Okay, so most religions, or pretty much all religions around the world, have some form of what you would call demonic possession or spirit possession. So obviously today we're going to be talking about, you know, the Catholic Christian idea of demonic possession and exorcism. So basically, in short, demonic possession means that an evil spirit, so a devil or a demon, is possessing the body, not the soul, but the body of a living person. So in Christian theology, Catholic theology, a devil or a demon cannot possess the soul of a person. So if you ever see in a horror movie when they say, you know, the demon is going to be possessing the soul, or the soul is damned to hell because they're possessed by the devil, that's not kosher in Catholic theology. So there's many ways a person can become possessed. So it could be that the person has opened up doorways in their life through occult practices like magic or Satanism or tarot Ouija cards, boards. Ouija boards, psychics, mediums, anything like that. And there's a few stages to possession. So, you know, not everyone that is experiencing supernatural problems is possessed. Most people, you would say, are not possessed, right? Full-blown possessions are on the rare side. So first, I would say the kind of the first category we have is infestation. So an infestation basically means that a dwelling place is being utilized by the evil spirits.
I've just opened up The Rite by Matt Vaglio, and the opening line of his paragraph on infestation is that this is what we know as the haunted house.
Right. I was just going to say, so the layman's term for an infestation would be a haunted house. So this would be any place that has odd occurrences, things moving around, you left a certain book in this room. When you come home, it's in a completely different room. I've also heard some exorcists say that the quote-unquote possession of an animal would count as infestation because the animal doesn't have a soul. So if a cat or a dog is possessed, quote-unquote, it would be more akin to an infestation. So when Jesus cast the demons out into the herd of pigs, it would almost be like the pigs were then infested, not possessed. I could be wrong about that, but I think that's correct.
You've heard actual exorcists say that?
Yeah, because you could say an animal is possessed, but possession, I don't know. I guess possession is more specific to a person.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even though the demon's not possessing the person's soul, it's still that, you know, an animal is not
they're not human.
Yeah, it's just a different type of thing. But so after possession, then you get what's called oppression. So oppression is when it's the attacks have moved beyond just things happening in a house to the attacks are directed at you or at a person. So this could be, you know, let's say things are physically being thrown at you, there's marks on your body, so you wake up and there's scratch marks and bite marks, things like that.
This is what many famous saints throughout history have experienced.
Right, correct? And probably most of the times, I guess it wouldn't move past this point, especially if you frequent going to church or the sacraments or confessions, things like that. But it's generally when the devil's trying to make his way into the person's body. But he's still outside the body at this point. And so there is no convulsion of limbs and speaking in tongues and anything like that. It's still completely external. And then the final form would be possession. So possession is when the devil finally gets inside the body. So you now have no control over your body. Not all the time, but at certain moments, the person kind of goes into a trance. Most people don't remember their possession. So during like an exorcism, when they're manifesting the signs of the demonic, they're not going to remember what happens. And you kind of find this throughout all different religions. When people go into possession, they don't remember it. So in Haitian voodoo, a big part of their religious rites is to become possessed by one of the spirits. And in voodoo, this is seen as a good thing, okay? So you want to achieve possession in voodoo. And in voodoo, when, let's say, they call it being ridden like a horse, which, so I'm like a loa or a voodoo spirit, they're called loas, are riding a person. Mm-hmm. That means that you are possessed by the spirit. And they say that after it happens, they have no memory of anything that occurred when they were being possessed.
Is that what was happening in that Vice video where in the basement in
Brooklyn? They were in the basement in Brooklyn, and the lady's like, I don't remember anything that she's happened.
Dancing with snakes.
So it's not just in the Christian tradition, but it does happen in other religions as well. I'm trying to think of what else I want to say about possession.
So this book also talks about obsession, mm-hmm, comes between oppression and possession, that it's basically demonic temptation. So it's kind of in between oppression and possession, but it's not its own. You wouldn't count it as its own category.
I have seen it counted. I'm kind of unsure as to exactly what constitutes, mm-hmm, obsession. I wasn't sure if it's like, it's more of a mental thing, like nightmares, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it almost seems like a form of oppression,
mm-hmm,
like a more mental form of it. So then finally, in possession, generally, if you've ever seen a movie, they always say, oh, how do you know a person's possessed? So the kind of the few telltale signs is that they're privy to knowledge that they shouldn't know. So let's say they know where you hid something in your house, and it's like how they would have no knowledge, mm-hmm, of you doing that. They are speaking in languages they don't know, even especially ancient languages like Aramaic, Latin, Greek. What else? They have an aversion of sacred objects. So I know some exorcists kind of do a test on a person. Like, so a person comes to them and they say, oh, I think I'm possessed. Sometimes they've used regular water and holy water to see if they react.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they react to the regular water and they're like, why don't you come back? Why don't you go to a doctor first and then right, come back and see me? I know, so from what I've heard from people that have, you know, done exorcisms, they say that people's bodies contort. So, mm-hmm, I guess it's similar to the horror movies, where the body looks very different, the person's face looks very different than they normally do. I personally don't know what that looks like in a real case, but I know they said it's very animalistic, like the person looks kind of like an animal. So past the possession, what an exorcism is the ritual used to expel the demon. So So there's a whole, history of exorcisms that go all the way back to the Gospels. Jesus exorcises many individuals from demons, kind of the modern interpretation that I completely disagree with, is that, you know, these are all just the old way of saying, oh, these people were sick and Jesus healed them. Well, Jesus also heals people of sicknesses.
Right.
But he also exorcises people. Right. So.
But he also commands the apostles to drive away demons.
Right. Right. And usually it's, I think a few, I want to say they say it's done out of prayer and fasting. So I want to say when an exorcist, before an exorcist does the exorcism, it's something called a black fast. They go on a fast to prepare themselves for the ritual. So currently, the ritual, you are able to do the ritual in either Latin, which is the church's official language, or the vernacular. So if you're in the United States or Canada, you would do it in English. However, the priest can ask to say it in Latin. Because from all the people I've heard of, they all say that a Latin exorcism is more effective than, you know, a vernacular exorcism, like an English exorcism or a Spanish one.
Now, you actually talked to a few exorcists. Yeah. I know I went with you once, Father...
Vincent Lambert,
Vincent Lambert from Indianapolis, the Archdiocese of Indianapolis. He came and spoke at Montclair State University in New Jersey twice, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I went the first time, and then we both went the second time.
So that's the only experience I've had interacting, quote unquote, with a real exorcist.
Yeah, and the first time I have a St. Michael chaplet and he blessed it for me, which I'm currently holding right now. I've also talked to the exorcist of the Diocese of Paterson, and he passed away, I think, a year ago or so. But he was an older priest, and I called, and kind of like dealing with most older people, he didn't quite understand that I wasn't possessed. So
yes, most old people think
I'm possessed. Yeah, that's how that came across. Most old, God. I called him up, and I just had questions about, you know, the ritual and possession.
You're
and
not exorcism. Possessed. You're just a weirdo.
Right? Exactly. I'm just a weirdo calling up because, you know, people don't do this. So on the phone, he was like, oh, well, you know. If you're experiencing these problems, like, do X, Y. I'm like, I'm not experiencing these problems. I'm just curious about the subject matter. And, it just was not getting through. He talked to me for about an hour, and I would say 90% of that was him speaking. It was, like, he was just... And he was nice. He was a nice guy, but... And it was interesting to talk to him. But I think those are the only real-life exorcists that I've interacted with.
Mm-hmm.
Then I've listened to a bunch of people on YouTube and
read
books.
Gabriel Amorth's
book. Yeah, Gabriel Amorth's book. Father Forteo's book, Interview with an Exorcist.
Okay, so in this day and age, nobody thinks about demonic possession, and when they do, they think of movies like The Exorcist and others, which we will talk about, to the point where even members of the church also don't believe in demonic possession. So how would a priest go about performing an exorcism in 2019?
Okay, so before the... And I was going to talk about this to you the other night when I didn't get a chance, so this, I guess, will just be new.
Okay. Breaking news.
Breaking news. So before the reforms of Vatican II, when you became a priest, you went through what were called the minor orders.
Mm-hmm.
So there, the minor orders are porter, lector, exorcist, acolyte, subdeacon, deacon, and then the priest. The exorcist, so at the time, the person in any of those functions is not a priest at the moment. And the exorcist function was to, I think, kind of recite deliverance prayers over the faithful at large. It wasn't mm-hmm. a solemn exorcism. But when you're talking about today, what if you know, you're possessed and you need an exorcist, every diocese is supposed to have one priest assigned to the function of exorcist. So what that means is, by every priest ordination, they all have the power to exorcise. However, they don't have the authority to do it without the bishop's permission. Mm-hmm. So a priest that is an exorcist goes to the bishop and says, okay, Mary Sue, who's spitting on crucifixes right now, wants an exorcism, right. And I've checked her out, we've had medical tests and blah, blah, blah. I think it's appropriate to perform the ritual. The bishop gives him the permission, and then he goes about performing it. So he needs the permission of the bishop, he needs medical evidence to say that this is not, you know, schizophrenia, this is not some form of mental illness, anything like that. And then after all that's said and done, and the person also has to agree to it. It can't be it can't be against the person's will, mm-hmm. to have an exorcism. It has to be consensual. After that, then they can perform the ritual. And in the ritual, the only time that, I mean, I guess in all Catholic theology, the only time a human being should ever talk to a demon is in the context of a priest in the rite of exorcism, when he's asking him the name. So he commands a demon to give him his name, and he commands a demon to give him a sign of his departure. So it'll be like, oh, the door will knock 3 times and you'll know I'm gone. Like, that's kind of, those are the only times when I guess a human being should be interacting with a demon in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Knowledgeable of that.
And also just to say, most people that are involved in what's called deliverance prayer. So a deliverance prayer is basically, I guess you can almost call it a minor exorcism. These are prayers that anyone, layperson, can pray, any regular priest can pray, and you're just basically asking, you know, a prayer of deliverance for a certain person. But the difference with a major exorcism is that you're not commanding the demon to do X, Y, and Z, you know, because you say so. Mm-hmm. That's a different story. But St. Michael specifically features very heavily in exorcist and deliverance material, because of his role in the Book of Revelation, that he's the angel that God charges to cast Satan out of heaven. So St. Michael is uniquely appropriate to the topic of demonic possessions and fallen angels and things like that. Mm-hmm. So you usually find the St. Michael prayer or his image somewhere attached to, you know, deliverance material.
Right, and the St. Michael prayer was instituted after the low mass in the late 1800s by Pope Leo XIII, after he supposedly had a vision of the devil attacking him.
Right.
During mass.
Right. So, unfortunately, it was done away with after the reforms of Vatican II.
Right.
But if you go to a Latin Mass today, you will, after every low Mass, will say it. So, yeah. And we're very pro-Latin Mass here, so. Dominus vobiscum.
Spirito tuo. The only Latin I really know off the top of my head. Anyway, so now that we've had an overview of what an exorcism is and how exorcists go about performing exorcisms, let's talk about some famous exorcist movies. We have a whole stack over here. We've seen probably 10 movies that touch on some form of demonic possession. Mm-hmm. But we're going to focus on 3.
Right.
With an honorary mention for a 4th, but we're going to focus on 3.
Right.
If we had to pick,
like, the top 3.
Like the trinity of exorcism movies.
Right. I think everyone knows what number one of them will be.
Yeah.
What year did it come out?
So The Exorcist was directed by William Friedkin, and it came out in 1973. It's based on the novel of the same name by William Peter Blatty, and I read the book. The movie is an extremely faithful adaptation of the book, and it's one of the best movies ever made.
Right. I mean, it's always up there with...
Yeah. It's definitely one of the best movies of the 1970s. The 1970s were a pinnacle of Hollywood cinema. And... I mean,
it's probably one of the most, if not the most, acclaimed horror movie.
Yeah.
I mean, you have, like, that...
Jaws,
Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Like, I feel like those are, like, big...
Halloween.
Yeah, big heavy hitters. But I feel like The Exorcist is usually at the top.
The Exorcist is, it's a mainstream movie that does not shy away from, I don't know, being vulgar where it has to, and I mean, it's not overly violent or sexual, but there are thematic
elements. Right, there's scenes in it that...
But it's also extremely Catholic.
Right, and The Exorcist is usually on the list of, like, the most Catholic movies.
So I'm assuming, if you're listening to this podcast, most people have seen this movie, but it's the story of a young girl who becomes possessed. She's the daughter of an actress. Her parents are divorced, so it's a single mother situation. They're living in Georgetown while the mother is filming her movie. And you have a priest who works at Georgetown. He's a psychiatrist there. And he's having a crisis of faith. His mother's dying. She lives in New York, so he's constantly commuting back and forth. And they kind of come to a head because the girl starts showing signs of possession. So she's, Reagan is her name. She's taken to all these doctors.
And what was the reason that they eventually say, though, why she became possessed?
Oh, because she was playing with a Ouija board.
Right, yeah.
She was talking to someone named Captain Howdy. You catch glimpses of this Captain Howdy. It's probably the creepiest part of the movie. So anyway, so she's showing signs of possession. She's a sweet girl who's now all of a sudden acting like a crazy person. So she's taken to all these doctors. It's, I think the most disturbing scene in the movie is her undergoing a spinal tap to see images of her brain. So all the medical procedures are filmed in a way where they're more
horrifying
than the actual demonic possession. So eventually the doctors, they approach the mother and they say, have you ever heard of an exorcist?
Like a witch doctor? Yeah,
we think you need to talk to a priest because we can't explain this. So Mrs. McNeil then approaches Father Karras because he's a psychiatrist and he doesn't believe it's demonic possession.
And that's kind of a trope after this among horror, among exorcism movies, is like the doubting priest.
Right. Which I don't blame him. He's also a Jesuit.
Yeah, Jesuits are banned.
And he just doesn't buy it.
Sorry.
He just doesn't understand. He can't imagine it being something so archaic. But he's a serious person, so he actually undergoes some tests, and he gets the approval once Reagan starts speaking backwards, and she's calling for a former exorcist, and he gets approved. So then they send for this other exorcist who's a much older priest, and they fail during the exorcism because the older priest dies of a heart attack, and then Father Karras sacrifices himself and lets the demon go into him, and then he jumps out of the window in a famous scene and tumbles down the really famous stairs.
Which we visited
when we were in Washington, D.C. last year. So that's basically it. So the movie ends with the girl, she's free of the possession, and I mean, it's a...
She remembers none of it.
Yeah, she doesn't remember any of it, and Father Karras does get his last rites because one of his fellow priests is nearby. So it ends in a good way, even though much right, destruction
it's
like
it's
is
a
gone.
Tragedy, yeah. But I don't know what you... How
it's
you
bittersweet.
Would... Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, so the movie is incredibly shot and acted. The music is great. It's really a quintessential American movie.
The music is so famous.
Yeah, and
probably that music and the Halloween music are like the two famous.
So that music isn't. That music is existed. Tubular Bells. Yeah, but it existed before the movie. It was sampled in the movie.
Okay.
Because it's this whole piece. I think it's 12 to 18 minutes long, and the famous bit is in the beginning, and then it goes into this long like synth 1970s style music.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't appear in the movie, so it's just that piece.
Right, the beginning.
And that's associated with the movie. So, we'll come back to The Exorcist in a bit, because we want to talk about the sequels. But we'll talk about, now, the second movie on our list is about 30 years later.
So, The Exorcism of Emily Rose.
Right.
So, now, I think with all these movies, they're all based on real events and true stories. So The Exorcist was based on, I think it was a case of a boy, right? Yeah. In Maryland, maybe? I think it was Georgetown.
It was in Maryland in 1948 or 49. Yeah,
but it was a boy. So The Exorcism of Emily Rose is based on a German case of possession of a girl named Annalise Mitchell. And I don't know what year it was.
It
was in the 70s. And so this is a real case. She was possessed, and they did the exorcisms, and she eventually died of all the afflictions. And they turned it into a movie called The Exorcism of Emily Rose. So they just put it into the United States, yeah. Named her Emily.
And they, I mean, it takes place, it's a contemporary movie, so it takes place in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah. So this movie, this one's probably my favorite out of all of them. So the girl goes away to college, she starts experiencing, supernatural events, a version of holy objects, things like that. So they, and she is religious, she's a Catholic or devout Catholic herself. She gets herself a priest, and they start performing the exorcism, and it's not really working. And eventually in the movie, I guess this is a spoiler alert, but okay, there you go. That's the warning. Eventually in the movie, you find out that she has a vision of the Virgin Mary, and the Virgin Mary offers her a choice. So the choice given to her is that you can continue to suffer with your possession, but a lot of people will be saved through your suffering. Or you can be rid of the demonic possessions and I think just go back to living a normal life. That's the movie version of it. Well, I'm not entirely sure of the real life version of that scenario, so I don't want to mix it up.
Was the movie version that she would go back to her normal life, or the demons would depart, but that didn't mean she would survive because she was pretty sick?
I'm not sure. I thought it was that the demons would go away and that she would.
Okay, because I thought it was the other way around.
I don't know. But the idea is that she chose to stay possessed because she wanted to, help, like the Virgin Mary said, she wanted to help out souls through her suffering. So she ends up doing that. She shows signs of stigmata, which are the wounds of Christ on her hands and her feet. And eventually she dies. The movie is framed like a courtroom drama. So basically what's going on is the priest that did the exorcism is being sued for negligent homicide.
Yeah.
He
prevented her from taking her medicine, right, prescribed by the doctors.
And was, instead prescribing this archaic ritual that ended up killing her. So that's basically the premise of the movie. What I think this movie does perfectly is capture the Catholic idea of redemptive suffering. So the idea that your suffering in life means something, it counts, it can help, you know, not only you in purgatory, but it can also help, you know, those around you. You can offer up your suffering. So mm-hmm. The whole idea of offering up your suffering is a very Catholic idea. And I think this movie puts that across very well, where I feel like most other movies don't get to that level.
Right, like The Exorcist doesn't.
Right, none of the other movies that I've seen do that.
You see physical suffering and the loss of life, but there's not this idea that
she's choosing to remain
in
her state of suffering.
Well, we're never in Reagan's head like we are in Emily Rose's.
Right.
So Reagan McNeil, all right, we're experiencing the initial suffering with her, but once she is possessed at the end, it's almost like she becomes the film's villain. And we're not like, oh, this is the little girl who's suffering. It's, oh, here's this demon that needs to be defeated. Whereas Emily Rose, it's never like that. It's, we're still kind of right next to her through it all.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because the movie starts out with she's dead. So everything's told in flashbacks and through court depositions and everything.
In the real case of Annalise Mitchell, I think they refer to her as a victim soul. So this is the idea that, you know, some saints have been, highly sensitive to diabolic attacks, or a soul that is basically plagued by problems their whole life.
I have a list here of saints. St. Catherine of Siena, St. Teresa of Avila, John Vianney, Gemma Galgani, those are a few that were...
Right. And basically...
Even Padre Pio.
Yeah. And essentially the idea behind the victim soul is that the person's life is pretty miserable. From a worldly standpoint. They're suffering constantly with very few, you know, pleasureful moments. But the soul's life is completely offered up in atonement for their sins and those of the whole world. I just quote Divine Mercy. And that's kind of how they frame the story of Annalise Mitchell. There's really no, at least in the movie, there's really no reason for why she gets possessed. I know in the real story of the girl in Germany, I think her mother was previously married or her father was, something like that. And whoever the former partner was, they said, like, put a curse on her firstborn or something like that, some kind of, like, witchcraft ritual. So I think that they think that was the impetus behind the possession. But in the movie, you don't get that. But the concept of redemptive suffering and God giving you a cross that you have to carry through, even though it may seem unfair and things like that, I think is something that everyone can relate to. You know, not every problem you face in life is of your own making. Sometimes it's external and you still have to suffer through it. And I think this movie brings that across very well.
Yeah, the ending is incredibly moving.
Yeah. I would say this is like one of my favorite movies of all time in general.
Yeah, see, I would say The Exorcist is one of my favorite movies of all time, but that's more from a filmmaking standpoint. Because I know you aren't a fan of the ending. I don't know if you want to talk about this now.
Yeah, we can.
It relates directly to
I think it relates. So
Emily Rose.
My position is that I love The Exorcist. However, I think the theology behind the ending of The Exorcist doesn't hold up. And my rationale for that is, first and foremost, a priest is concerned with the well-being of the person's soul. If At the end of the movie, Reagan was possessed, which she was.
If she was still possessed.
Yeah, if she was still possessed. Reagan, just by being possessed, does not mean that she's going to be damned to hell. Okay, so a person that is possessed is not necessarily in a state of mortal sin. So what Father Karras does in the movie is he tells the demon to come into him. So leave her, come into him, which right off the bat is a bad idea. Okay, there's no, I think, good reason to invite a demon into your body, even if it's to, quote-unquote, save the other person. For all he knows, Reagan could still be possessed, and now they're both possessed.
Mm-hmm.
So he invites the demon into him. Now, I give it that Karras's motives are in the right place, but I still don't think the theology behind it is good reasons. So he invites the demon in.
He's also acting on pure emotion.
Oh, yeah, he's very upset. No, but but I think his emotions are in the right place. Yeah. He's upset. He wants to help Reagan. So he invites the demon into him and then kills himself. So, I mean, pass judgment here on you know, suicide victims or things, but within the Catholic Church, you know, suicide is not, it is considered a sin, right? Whether the person's culpability is completely up is, you know, that's between them and God.
If it's in a case of a sacrifice, is that...
I'm not sure in the ending of The Exorcist, did Father Karras willingly say, I'm going to go kill myself, or did he jump out the window and he ended up dying? But it's kind of ambiguous. I think it sends a bad message to on two parts. So one is to say, let's invite the demon into me, and then I'm going to go kill myself to get rid of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So those are two big no-nos. Okay, so you don't invite the demon in and you don't kill yourself. He's only, if he is guilty of suicide, he's only saved by a chance encounter that another priest is there to give him last rites.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you know, okay, what if that priest wasn't there? Now you're laying there dead, guilty of killing yourself and possessed. So it's like, I don't know. I wouldn't want to be Karras at that moment. I think it's a sensational ending to the movie. You know, it carries over well in as a Hollywood movie, but I don't think it's, a very good ending theologically. Because I remember when I first saw it, I was like, it didn't work.
Right. Well, that was my reaction when I first saw it.
And it didn't...
I still watch it, it's... But the whole build-up is to have, we're going to have an exorcism. And then when both priests die without actually solving the problem...
Right. And it doesn't work, not in the sense of Emily Rose. Emily Rose doesn't work because they give you a reason for it.
Right, but even if it didn't work and it just, like, Reagan's body gave out before the demon relinquished a hold, okay, I guess that could happen, but when you're building a whole movie around, The Exorcist, like, you have the famous shot of Father Maron showing up by taxi with the light coming out of the window, and it's one of the most dramatic single shots in a movie, and after all that he dies without really putting up a fight, and then Karras has to kill himself to save the girl. It's like, well, then what was the whole point of the exorcism? Was right. Like, it's almost subversive. It's like, right. Oh, it actually doesn't matter,
right? And you know, to save Reagan, I think at the end of the day he's looking at it in a worldly sense. He's trying to save her body and not seeing, I guess, the spiritual dimension beyond it, that it's not really about that. So even if Reagan dies, if she's not in a state of sin, she's not going to be in hell. So
right.
Now, again, I'm saying, you know, Karras is very emotional at that point, but I just don't see that as a good ending.
Mm-hmm.
It always bothers me. Every time I watch the movie, I'm like, oh, maybe this time when I watch it, I'll get past it, and it just doesn't work for me. Yeah. I think Emily Rose is a much better movie from an actual theological standpoint. And aside from that, I think it just carries a deeper weight to it with the whole theme of redemptive suffering, where The Exorcist just doesn't get there. So I will say The Exorcism of Emily Rose is the superior movie.
I don't know if I could say that, but I really like both of them. And I like Emily Rose for the theology.
Well, I mean, when I say superior movie, yeah. I don't mean in a filmmaking but I just mean from the perspective of exorcisms and possessions, I think it's clearly superior.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now our third movie, I guess, kind of falls in between the two in that. So it came out in 2011. I remember going in college with Focus Missionaries and a bunch of other students from our Newman Catholic Club. It's The Rite, which is based on a book by a journalist, the book I referenced before, The Rite, The Making of a Modern Exorcist. So I've seen the movie 3 or 4 times. I've always liked it. I mean, there are some parts with it that are clearly theologically iffy. The main point being that the main character is a seminarian, and he gives last rites at one point, and then at the end he partakes in an exorcism, which I guess is done out of an emergency, but it's still not process is done.
Yeah.
But reading the book, which I haven't finished because, of course, I try to do this ahead of recording and then it never works out, but I'm 3/4 of the way through the book, and the book is very serious, and the movie, of course, changes some things to make it more...
Right, I mean, it stars Anthony Hopkins.
But the book is definitely worth checking out if you don't want to... Nobody will probably ever watch this movie. So Anthony Hopkins is...
I really like it, too. I think it's a very good movie.
Anthony Hopkins is the star, but he's not the main character. He's
the star power.
Yeah, he is the exorcist who trains the seminarian. So the seminarian is played by Colin O'Donoghue, who... Chris is laughing. So he is Captain Hook.
So if for everyone to go, just stop this podcast right now and go watch 7 seasons of Once Upon a Time from ABC, because it's a great show, and I just invalidated our whole thing.
So Colin O'Donoghue is an Irish actor who plays the hunky Captain Hook on Once Upon a Time, and he wears eyeshadow. But in this movie, which it's true.
I know.
In this movie, he's playing an American, but he's having a crisis of faith. So he goes into the seminary. He seems lost. He's the son of a mortician.
It is all based on a true story, too.
It is based on the real story. So the real exorcist in The Rite book is Father Gary Thomas, who was also the son of a mortician, but he didn't have a crisis of faith. So Hollywood changed it to make it more dramatic. So the seminarian is named Michael, and in the movie, his father's played by Rucker Hauer, and his father's distant. His mother passed away when he was young, and you find out that he bent the holy card and the crucifix during his mother's funeral, so he kind of renounced God. But he was at a loss in his young adulthood, so he joined the seminary, and right when he's about to become a priest, he offers a letter of resignation. Then Father Toby Jones shows up, and he just looks like a creep. He's the voice of Dobby.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And he says, I think you're making a mistake. By the way, have you heard of exorcisms? They're... Rome wants an exorcist in every archdiocese, so I'm going to send you to Rome.
Which I guess yes, I agree that
it is outlandish.
It's outlandish, but just for the sake of the movie, I could see if someone, a priest or a seminarian's going through a crisis of faith, it's like, I mean, showing them an exorcism would cure that,
right?
I guess.
Right, but it's also so. The movie does slip up in some, so it doesn't know how a seminary works and how, what the role of a seminarian is. But the movie treats Catholicism very respectfully.
Right.
So once he's in Rome, So Kieran Hines plays like the head exorcist teacher in the Vatican, and he lectures and he senses that, oh, Michael, the seminarian, is having this weird crisis of faith. So he sends him to Father Anthony Hopkins.
Father Anthony Hopkins.
The hills of Rome, surrounded by tons of stray cats, to look in on a few exorcisms. And so the main exorcism that Anthony Hopkins performs is on a young Italian girl who's pregnant. He says, oh, she was raped by her father and she's having psychological trauma, so this isn't actually demonic possession. She ends up dying in the hospital, so he's now feeling lost, and then he finds out that he gets a phone call from his father, but then he finds out the next day that his father died, so he realized that wasn't actually his father on the phone, so he's having all these creepy occurrences. And then Anthony Hopkins somehow gets possessed, which is also a little...
I don't really know why.
I think he despairs after the girl dies.
Is that why?
I think that's why.
Yeah.
I don't think we're supposed to question it.
Right, it's not, yeah.
So Michael's become acquainted with this Italian reporter, and they both go and they save Anthony Hopkins from his demonic possession, and Michael, he doesn't know how to win, and finally the possessed Hopkins tells him, like, oh, you believe in me and you know that I'm gonna destroy you, and Michael says, I do believe in you, but if I believe in you, that also means I believe in God, and he basically powers up.
He levels up
and concludes the exorcism that I guess wouldn't be valid, and the movie ends with him becoming a priest.
Not gonna lie. Father, forgive me for the sins I would commit. I'd do an exorcism if it was present. Oh boy.
So the movie ends with him performing confessions, and he's... What I liked about the movie is that he doesn't... So they build upon the relationship between the seminarian and the reporter. And you think it might...
Go somewhere,
but it remains completely platonic, which I respect. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, you're not forcing this priest character to break any vows. Mm-hmm. And then he winds up actually going into the priesthood. It's not right. Like he...
Because the end is him... putting on the purple stole, going into the confessional.
So that's The Rite.
I really like The Rite. I listened to two videos of the actual guy. It's Gary Thomas. Father Gary Thomas.
Yeah. Which I think he's from California.
So I found his videos very interesting.
I'm assuming he was an advisor on the movie.
He was, yeah. Because I remember when I listened to him, he mentioned about how he would give the young actor, who's Colin O'Donoghue, like, you know, tips and this and that. Mm-hmm. And he never actually mentioned Anthony Hopkins by name, but he's like, oh, you know, the really big star there. Like, I had to tell him, like, you know, this wasn't right. You got to do it this way. So this guy was schooling Anthony Hopkins on the etiquette of exorcism.
Anthony Hopkins is good at it.
No, he is very good.
I think his possession scene's a little overdone.
Yeah, I don't mind it.
Yeah, I mean, some of his lines are a little... Like, he goes, dude, and it's just cringy.
Yeah.
But, again, it's a movie... I've seen it at this point probably 5 or 6 times. Like, I saw it in college. It was a field trip for the Newman Center.
Field trip.
So, yeah, so those are the three exorcist movies that I would hold above all others. I think the fourth movie, like if we were to make a Mount Rushmore out of all the other movies that we've seen that have some form of possession scene, so The Conjuring's one, you have all the Exorcist sequels, there's The Possession, which is about the Jewish
one, so which it's like I found the rabbi really
performing the exorcism. But I would say that my number four on the Mount Rushmore would be The Exorcist 3, which is technically not an exorcist movie. So it's based on the sequel to William Peter Blatty's exorcist novel. His sequel was called Legion, and it was basically a serial killer novel. So it follows the police detective from The Exorcist. The book takes place many years later, and there's a serial killer who's apparently come back, and he's been dead, so they don't know what's going on. And then there is a possessed body in the book. It's the body of the serial killer has been possessed by a demon, and he's been committing the murders. The movie, however, they wanted to tie into The Exorcist in some way, and this came out in 1990, which is 17 years after the first movie, and 12 years after The Exorcist 2, which is one of the worst movies ever made.
Exorcist 2, The Heretic, is horrible.
It's awful. So I would recommend... So in addition to The Exorcist 3, there are two prequels, and they're both the same movie. There were a bunch of studio issues, so they reshot the movie after filming it once. So there's The Exorcist The Beginning, which is the second version, but it came out first in 2005. It's the more Hollywood horror movie-esque version, so it has better special effects, but it's a little more schlocky. Then you have the first version, which is Dominion prequel to The Exorcist, directed by Paul Schrader. It's much more artful, but the special effects budget was almost zero, so it has bad special effects. It's a more cerebral movie, but I would recommend seeing both of them just for the experience.
Yeah, they're not bad.
Yeah, they're fine.
The only one I wouldn't see is Exorcist 2.
So 2 is awful. But Exorcist 3 is a really cool, very... I guess to use the word cerebral, like it's a very slow burn, creepy murder mystery.
Yeah. I would say it's scarier than the original Exorcist.
And the studio wanted an Exorcist scene, so they shoved a random priest in and he dies a really gruesome death. And in order to really sell it, instead of just having this, so the serial killer in the movie is played by Brad Dourif, who's famously Wormtongue from Lord of the Rings. So he's the Gemini killer who died 15 years before. But they tweak it by saying that the body is not the Gemini killer. The body is actually Father Karras from The Exorcist. So Jason Miller came back, and he's almost 20 years older. And he is the possessed person. So he is in this mental asylum. Like, oh, they found this guy wandering. And then when... So the cop is played by George C. Scott in this movie. And Scott is talking to his old friend Karras, but... In that scene, once Karras wakes up and he's possessed, Brad Dourif fills in. So it's this back and forth between the two actors. The dialogue is good, the acting is good, it's just a little weird, and then you have a random exorcism scene. So there have been fan edits that try to eliminate this and go back to the original novel. They get rid of the whole exorcist part. And then recently, I think it was 2-3 years ago, they came out with a director's cut that actually... uses old VHS prints and I think some negatives and tries to splice together a working print of the script, which I haven't watched yet, but I've read online that it's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like the book, so I would definitely want to check this out.
Yeah.
But Exorcist 3 is really good.
Yeah, it is. And no one knows about it.
Yeah.
Or at least from my... experience.
You have a weird dream sequence where it's like Patrick Ewing is playing an angel and Samuel Jackson's in it. And it's just bizarre. It's like Grand Central Station with all these people dressed as angels, but then like all the people that have died in the movie by the serial killer have, because the killer's decapitating people, so all the people are in the dream and their necks are sewn together.
Mm-hmm.
It's just very bizarre.
Yeah.
And there's some really creepy imagery, like using religious statues and Jesus's eyes open at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And then famously, there's a really shocking jump scare. Like, it's a movie, the movie actually does what a jump scare is supposed to do, where you're just waiting and waiting and waiting, and you know something's going to happen, but you don't know what. And then
it's like, okay, you think it's maybe it's not going to happen, and then holy crap.
And it's one jump scare in a movie that's almost 2 hours, right. Whereas nowadays horror movies are jump scare after one another, and they don't... It's like you watch a movie and you're pissed off because it's like, oh, I'm going to get scared in the next 5 minutes. Whereas this, it's actually a slow build to something that's a little deeper and, oh, and there's one scare.
Right.
So.
And I mean, you mentioned the name of the book that it's based on. So it's based on the book Legion.
Yeah.
Which is a reference to the gospel when Jesus asked the possessed man, you know, he asked the demon, what's your name? And it says, we are Legion, or our name is Legion, for we are many. So mm-hmm. I just thought that was a cool little title for it.
I would highly recommend the book. It's one of the better books I've read. I like it more than The Exorcist book, because I read The Exorcist book after I saw the movie, and they're basically the same thing, so I don't know. It's hard to distinguish between the two.
Yeah, it's more of a horror movie than it is, like you said, an exorcism movie.
Yeah.
I guess, but it does have the exorcism.
It's almost a thriller.
Yeah, it's more of a thriller.
It's not
an action. It is scary, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I really like it. And then, I guess we wanted to just mention a few scenes in generic movies that have exorcists or exorcisms in them. So one being in The Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers, when Gandalf, Aragorn, Gimli, and Legolas go to Rohan, and they go to meet King Theoden, and Theoden is, quote-unquote, possessed by Saruman in the hall. And Gandalf...
He doesn't use the power of Christ to...
He doesn't. He uses the power of Gandalf the White to free King Theoden from the clutches of Saruman. But again, you know, Tolkien was obviously a devout Catholic, and that scene is clearly an exorcism scene in a fantasy world. Another scene where, you know, you have an exorcism is in Harry Potter, Order of the Phoenix. So it's the fifth movie. At the very end, Voldemort kind of possesses Harry, and Harry's kind of fighting back and forth with him until, you know, I guess Harry wins out, and he fights back, and he kind of casts Voldemort out of him, out of his body. And that's kind of another, you know, exorcism-esque scene.
This is the end. But that's literally a parody of The Exorcist. But that's...
Right. The Exorcism of Jonah Hill.
Yeah. That's such a good movie.
It is. It's a really good movie.
So what is he... Does he... I know he's praying to God, but does he do something to warrant having the giant demon attack him?
They're all open. I want to talk about invitations here.
The whole point of that movie is that they're all bad people,
and
they haven't been raptured.
Right.
And then they have to actually do good things to go to heaven and meet the Backstreet Boys, because that's the theology.
It's so funny. The idea, I guess, is just to say, when you watch movies that aren't necessarily a horror movie, but sometimes the theme of possession and exorcism does come through. And it's interesting to compare those scenes to the actual, you know, exorcist movies.
Right. Now, do you know about exorcisms in other religions besides what we've seen from The Possession?
So in The Possession, it's the Jewish exorcism movie. So in Judaism, there's the idea of the Dybbuk, which I want to say, oh my God, I'm really going to mess this term up. I want to say it deals with something called transmigration, which...
Like going across the Bering Strait?
Oh my God, be quiet, Steve. I want to say it's transmigration where it's like a person's soul didn't get to the afterlife or something like that. But you do have, like in Buddhism, you have
demons, and there are prayers to keep them away and things like that. I want to say in Hinduism, I mean, Kali kind of looks like a demon. So Kali Ma is the female Hindu goddess that everyone's familiar with from Temple of Doom.
Right, but, and he's possessed in that.
Yes, he is. He's possessed in that. You're right.
And Short Round gets him free by
burning. So let's all pray to Saint Short Round. Saint Short Round deliver us from evil. Where was I? Oh, I think Kali has to do with like fighting demons though. Islam has the idea of Iblis. Jinn. Well, Iblis is a jinn, and Iblis is basically the Satan in Islam. And he is a jinn or a genie, and they're basically like another form of angel. So in Christianity and Judaism, you have angels and fallen angels, aka demons. Where in Islam, you have angels. I guess you have fallen angels, I'm not sure, but you also have jinn, the genies. And they're usually bad. But their actual exorcism ritual, I'm not sure about. I think there probably is something, but I wouldn't totally know what it is. But I will find out. I'll go to my local imam and ask him for an exorcism. Salaam alaikum. I mean, I think the Catholic Church is the only... I'm probably going to be wrong with that. But it's one of the few that has a very defined ritual for it. Even I think the Eastern Orthodox have deliverance-esque prayers, but I don't know if they have a ritual for exorcism, where the Catholic Church clearly does. I'm holding it right now. I have a few versions of the Roman ritual and the ritual of exorcism.
Whereas I'm holding the Malleus Maleficarum, but that's...
The hammer of the witches.
That's more witches
than exorcism. But, yeah. So...
Couple of lay exorcists over here.
Yeah, we could be demon hunters, like Supernatural.
We shouldn't.
We should.
We're not supposed
to. Yes, we are. So, with that being said,
with Chris, I don't know, sort of blaspheming.
I'm not blaspheming. I'll send it off in Latin if you want me to, in the name of the Father.
Sure.
Would you like to end the podcast first, and then I'll do it.
All right, thank you for listening to our episode. We really recommend the four movies that we talked about. And yeah, I will write up some show notes. I'm sure Chris has a lot of supplemental my material. But yeah, thank you for listening.
And happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.
Nomini Patris, Filii, et Spiritus Sancti, Amen.